Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all our other episodes at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to Season 3, Episode 15 of Cinematica. My name's Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio is...
Kaylee Carruthers, live from Canada for the very last time.
Exactly. Kaylee's in Canada, but I'm alone here in Cinematica Towers because Sai is still on the ferry coming back from his holidays. So for those of you who are Simon fans... maybe you should just switch off now because he'll be back next week to tell us all about his cinematic adventures. Otherwise, it's just Kaylee and myself to talk about all of the things that we have going on. This is your last call from Canada. Are you looking forward to coming back?
I am looking forward to coming back. I've heard from friends that my, as Simon calls him, my man friend is getting a bit restless and lonely without me. So...
Well, as you would. He's downstairs transacting business in a cafe at the moment.
Of course. And I'm excited to get back to New Zealand and our delicious coffee and very, very classy and comfortable cinemas. We have no idea how good we have it, people. It is just, my butt will be much happier in those seats.
Amen, sister. Absolutely. On today's program, we're going to be talking about the long-awaited The Master, Paul Thomas Anderson's. This is something we've been talking about on the show since it was announced. So it may even have been a topic of conversation here for like a year. And finally, we get to actually talk about watching the film itself. So we'll be doing that a little bit later on. There's a crime thriller from Belfast in Northern Ireland called Whole Lot of Soul, which stars Brendan Fraser. We'll be talking about that one a little bit later on. We will be discussing some of the goings-on at Sundance and updating you about that sort of carry-on a little bit later on. And the new Quentin Tarantino, Django Unchained, opens this weekend in New Zealand cinemas. And that'll be our third review for the day. So lots to look forward to in the show. But first, Kaylee, you've been monitoring remotely our social media presence. What have people been saying about us?
We have lots of two-word reviews this week, which is fantastic. So Uther Lives says The Masters is a cult classic. Mm-hmm. One of our favorite and most excited listeners, Rudy Six, said, "Wow, I just watched The Imposter. Excellent documentary. Very well done, my friends." His two-word review is holy sheet. And the Mercus two-word review for Seven Psychopaths is Sam's show.
Oh, yeah, hence Sam Rockwell.
Yes. And Reese Pie, whose two-word review we read last week on the show, said, "Great waking up to a new podcast this morning, and even better to hear the first two-word review I ever did being read out. Thanks." Well, thank you, and keep them coming.
Right. Well, I spent a little bit of time last night at dinner with another pair of regular podcast listeners, so Stephen Moore and CJ. Thanks very much for feeding me last night. And they alerted me to the fact that last week's guest presenter, Steve Gray, the real Steve Gray, has a Wikipedia page. And look at this. I have it in front of me right now. The latest update on Steve Gray, TV presenter, on Wikipedia, it says, "In 2013, Gray joined the New Zealand cinema podcast Cinematica as part of the film review panel."
So, I think I know who updates that Wikipedia page now.
And so isn't that excellent? And what that leads me to believe that we're missing out on, you know, there, because there's no link to Cinematica there. We don't have our own Wikipedia page. And, of course, you're not really allowed. It's not the done thing to start your own Wikipedia page, is it? You know, the editors look down on that. It's all got to be secondary sources and primary sources, etc. So does anybody want to volunteer? Any of our listeners want to volunteer and give us a Wikipedia page? We'll tell you what to put.
That'd be great. We can send you, like, photos of us and, like, you know, secrets behind the scenes secrets.
Indeed. And maybe that we could, now that we've been mentioned in The Listener, that would be, you know, that constitutes a good secondary source, doesn't it? I'm sure. Yeah, so that's what's been going on in the virtual world. What's been going on in the real world? Have New Zealanders been going to the movies? Is the weather has been alternating between vile and beautiful with not much in between?
They have. They've still been going to the movies, which is excellent to see. Good numbers. Way to go, New Zealanders.
Yeah.
Sun safety. It's important, especially in New Zealand.
Yep. So what have they been going to see?
At number five this week, down from... Or is it at five? Sorry, it's hard to read. At number five this week, Rise of the Guardians. At number four, The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. Premiering at number three is Gangster Squad. So people still went to see it, even though I didn't like it, but that's okay.
No, that's the Goz, isn't it? That's the Goz proving to still be a bit of a draw card.
It is. I did see many friends updating on Facebook that they were going on dates with their husbands or partners to go see Gangster Squad to get their Gosling fill. So it does that. It does that indeed. So good on you, ladies. Good on you. Life of Pi is sitting at number two, and still in the number one position is Les Mis.
Wow, that is interesting. I'm still hearing lots and lots of fantastic feedback about Life of Pi, so I get the feeling that, based on word of mouth, that will have quite the lifespan, actually. And certainly lots of people tempted to try 3D who wouldn't normally be interested in it. So I think it's doing its job as a film on its own and also as a way of introducing people to the new technology. So time to look now at, I guess, the most recent releases. So, Paul Thomas Anderson, we've been waiting for The Master for so long. What is the verdict?
There will be people on the outside who will not understand the condition you men have. Now, upon your shoulders rests the responsibility of a post-war world.
And smile.
You can start a business, filling station, grocery, or hardware store. Get a few acres of land and raise some chickens.
You're acting aggressive because you drink too much alcohol.
What do you do?
I am a writer, a doctor, a nuclear physicist, a theoretical philosopher. But above all, I am a man, just like you.
All right. Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman in Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master, which premiered in the US in September, I think, and there's a lot of excitement among the movie fans, the cinephiles here in New Zealand about that coming here, particularly people who love Anderson's earlier work. There Will Be Blood, which of course was a sensational film. Punch Drunk Love, Magnolia, Boogie Nights. The guy has got form, and this looked like it was going to be the next in the sort of inevitable rise to cinematic sainthood for Anderson. And it's a film about Joaquin Phoenix's character, who leaves the army at the end of World War II, and he's got a drinking problem and a few personal issues that he's trying to wrestle with. And he basically wanders from misadventure to misadventure across the United States until he stows away on a yacht in San Francisco and meets the mysterious Philip Seymour Hoffman, who is an author and a mystic and a guru and somebody who seems to be wanting to start his own religion. And he sees a little bit of somebody who he thinks he might be able to save in Joaquin Phoenix's character. And so Phoenix, the character's called Freddie Quells, he gets sort of dragged in, embroiled in all of the shenanigans that ensue. And they travel across the United States trying to encourage more followers and get people to buy this guy's books and maybe even get them to donate their fortunes to him. It's a beautiful film, is it not, Kaylee?
It is incredible. I was so excited to watch this. I was riding that wave of hype. I was excited. I really like Joaquin Phoenix. I think he's an incredibly talented actor who can just pull off just about anything. And I was so, so rewarded watching this film. The performances are incredible. It is long. It is one of those films that are coming out in this Oscar rush that do clock in over two, just this one's just over 2 hours. but it's well worth it. If you, I mean, if you like Paul Thomas Anderson's films, this is another one that just sets the standard of cinema so high. It's amazing. I loved it. Loved it.
Oh, that's good. That's very high praise. I was a little bit disappointed, I must say, and I'm not quite sure whether it's because my expectations were set so high. I loved There Will Be Blood because it seemed to me that in addition to being an intense psychological study of obsession and of male competitive spirit, There Will Be Blood was also about the birth of an industry and American capitalism, and it had something to say about a society. And I really appreciated that. I love films that work on those multiple levels. This one, I loved the craft of it. I thought the look, the feel, the acting, the production design, the cinematography, everything about the manufacture of the film I thought was absolutely outstanding. But then I found myself sitting there as the credits rolled at the end going, what was that about, really? What was the point of all of that? You know, I understood that it was, again, another sort of father figure, son figure film that Anderson makes quite a lot of, mentor figures. I understood the portrait of a tortured, troubled, psychologically maladjusted individual, which is what Joaquin Phoenix's character is, but I wasn't sure that it had anything bigger to say about America, about post-war trauma. It just seemed to me that if I scratched it too deep, I'm not sure if I'd find very much there. That may just be a first viewing problem. It may be something that if I watch it again, I'll get more out of it. But I guess I was hoping for more. And you know, these are really unfair criticisms on my part, because there are not very many films that actually match what my expectations of The Master were going to be, and I'm usually a lot kinder to them. So perhaps I should be a little bit kinder to The Master.
Well, it is a film that isn't neatly tied up at the end. You know, it's something where it's part of a journey. It's part of the character played by Joaquin Phoenix. It's a big part of his life, but it's the beginning of a journey. It's the beginning of this fictionalized sort of birth of Scientology, but it's not a film about Scientology because we don't want to get in trouble with Scientologists. But really, if you know the story of how Scientology came around, and if you've read Dianetics and you sort of have done a bit of research, you recognize a lot of what's in this film, and it's really well researched and it comes across quite accurately. And I've worked, I think the reason like I was so impressed with the performances is that I've worked with adults with addiction before, and Joaquin Phoenix's portrayal of someone with addiction who is suffering, who has mental issues going on, was spot on. Like, it was scary how much he resembled people I'd worked with before.
Yes, and resembled people that I knew as well. And it's a faultless performance, a brave, brave performance as well. As usual, Joaquin Phoenix seems to have absolutely no ego when it comes to presenting himself on screen. This is an ugly character, and with very difficult to feel sympathy for. Perhaps that's not the point.
But maybe that's why it's a bit more difficult to watch, because you don't really feel sympathy for this character, and it isn't tied up nicely. It isn't a really it doesn't just end, and there isn't really a resolution. I mean, that is one of the difficult things about the film. I remember when I watched it and when it ended. Not to be spoilers, but I had to sit there for a minute and sort of think about it and be like, what did I just see? Like, what was that journey that I just took?
I think it's definitely a film that will reward a second viewing. And I found that with There Will Be Blood as well, that the layers did not become immediately apparent. And I suspect that will be the case with this film as well. I want to, if you want to know more about The Master, then I suggest you head back into the archives and have a listen to our end of year special, where special guest Glenn Kenny from New York picked The Master as his pick of the year and did a very nice job of setting the scene for the film. So if you don't like my opinion, well, there's always somebody else's. And I do feel that this is the film that I'm going to get more out of as time goes by. There's some shots of staggering beauty in the film. It was shot on 70mm, a very, very rare thing these days. It had compositions that Stanley Kubrick or Terrence Malick would be proud to have included in one of their films. And I want to make a point of directing your attention towards the score. Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead, I think, if he doesn't get the Best Original Score Oscar for this, then they've got cotton wool in their ears, frankly, because this is like the finest modern classical music. It sounded like sort of Benjamin Britten or something like that. The film is completely different. Each scene, each shot would be completely different with a different musical backing to it. He just takes it to another level entirely, and I think that Johnny Greenwood's score, just absolutely sensational.
Agreed.
Do you agree? You concur?
I concur.
So I'm going to put you on the spot now, Kaylee, and see if you've come up with two words for the master.
Yes, my two words for the master will be master cinema.
Okie dokie. Well, I'm going to pun on master too, and I'm going to just say questionable mastery, just because my personal jury is still out on that one. But
that's a good two-word review.
I know. I feel like I've got to raise my game.
It's 2013, you got to step it up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're getting so many good ones from listeners. And I found out at dinner last night that apparently CJ's book club have started doing two-word reviews. So it's getting out. It's getting out into the world, these things. And so we really need to try and
set... We need that Wikipedia page.
We do.
We need to take credit for that hashtag two-word review thing.
Get onto it, people. Okay, time to pay a trip to Belfast.
Tell me everything.
I had no money, so I borrowed some from my dog, Flynn.
How much do you still owe me?
Santa's gonna give me 2 days or he's gonna take my son.
What?
He wants him for his girlfriend.
I want
him. That's when I robbed the fish market to get the money back.
Oh, we're going on an operation.
DBR, sir.
I'll drive.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, please, God, no.
All I got was this brown bag.
He got the brown bag.
What's in it, MD?
Trouble. Big trouble.
Okay, Whole Lot of Soul is a film that's just arrived in New Zealand on limited release. It's made in Northern Ireland with the support of the Northern Irish Film Board. And it's written and directed by a chap called Terry George, who I thought sounded familiar, so I looked him up. And this is the guy that made Hotel Rwanda a few years ago, which was a film that absolutely reduced me to a gibbering wreck in the cinema. I have a great deal of fondness for that film. And also, he won the Academy Award last year for Best Short, for Best Narrative Short. So this is a guy who's got some form, right? So, looking forward to it. And it's a comedy thriller set in Belfast, modern-day Belfast. Brendan Fraser, the actor from Journey to the Centre of the Earth and various other things, he plays an American who's holed up in Belfast, sort of on the run from some trouble, maybe some girl trouble, maybe some criminal trouble, and he's looking after his uncle's antique shop. And he gets involved somehow with the local criminal fraternity, one of whom ends up sort of taking him hostage with an antique machine gun, but not only taking him hostage, but also taking an Ethiopian refugee who works across the road, two gypsy children, and a baby. And while they're tucked away in this antique shop, the Irish police, the Northern Irish police, to be more precise, in the form of Colm Meaney, is outside trying to do some hostage negotiating. The SAS are outside as well for no apparent reason. And also the local mafia, who actually are the ones that really, really want to get him and the contents of that briefcase. I've made this sound like it's a much more interesting film than it is.
Yeah,
because frankly, this is a film where the execution is really what lets it down. The script is poor, the characterizations are poor, the direction is poor. It's all kind of shoddy. It's a comedy thriller, and yet the first thing that happens is a woman gets beaten, and you think, that's not funny. Are you intending that to be funny? Because it's not funny. And there's a lot of sort of missteps in tone throughout. And the jokes, such as they are not particularly funny jokes. I recommend that if you're at all interested in this film, look up the trailer online. It's about 2.5 minutes long, and that will do you nicely, because that really is all you need to know. And squeezed into 2.5 minutes that won't be wasted. Don't waste your time down at the pictures for it, because it seems like a really big misstep, and such a disappointment from people that I would have thought would really know better. If you're wondering about the title, Whole Lot of Soul, that's actually not the title that it has in the US. In the US, it's called something like Stakeout or something, anyway, something much more generic. Whole Lot of Soul is the name of a fish market that has been robbed by a young man trying to pay off his gambling debts. And so that pun there is pretty much the extent of the humour in the film. You're going to ask me now, Kaylee, aren't you, for a two-word review for Whole Lot of Soul.
I am.
And I'm going to have to think of one. And I'm going to say something like something fishy. Basically, see, I told you, I can't do two in a row. I can't do two good ones in a row. Not up to it. This is a film that I was disappointed by, and I suspect you will be too.
Womp womp.
Time for some news.
The New Zealand motion picture exhibition business was saddened to hear of the recent passing of Rodney Cook, owner of the Academy Cinema and the Art House Cinemas chain, after a long illness.
Yes, he had been very poorly, Rodney. I got to know him while I was running the Paramount Theatre in Wellington, and we were independents struggling to get product and struggling to get people through the door, and so we got to know each other reasonably well. He was a unique character, was Rodney Cook. For a very long time, he refused to have FPOS at his facility in told people that there was a money machine just around the corner if they wanted to go and get cash. He did things his way, but he ran a fantastic business down there in Christchurch, because he really cornered the market in the kind of quality art house, soft art house that does really well here in New Zealand. And I think that he helped create a market down there, and that's a market that hasn't been replaced after his business was damaged by the earthquake. He was, I think, looking for a new location to reopen. The building that the Academy Cinema is in is basically completely condemned, if it's not been demolished already. And so he was looking for a new location, but of course Christchurch being struggling for quality real estate at the moment, he wasn't really able to find any. It was very sad to hear of his passing, because, you know, New Zealand cinema for a long time had quite a few of those sorts of characters, the people that actually worked the counter, and you met them at the when you went to buy your tickets. Rodney, I went down there once to see Gloomy Sunday, a film that played in Christchurch for years and years and years, and he actually found the film and brought it to New Zealand and had the distribution rights for it. And I went there one morning to watch Gloomy Sunday, and he would wait to see how many people turned up to decide which cinema to put it on in, right? So if he had more than 15 people, he would move it to the bigger cinema so that everybody could get in. We watched it in one of his little theaterettes, and he made a wee speech beforehand to talk about how proud he was of finding it and how it's the longest running. It was the longest running film in Christchurch history, and there was something about that personal touch that I think is lost from a lot of our cinema experiences. I think that corporatization of the movie going experience and the international chains and what have you. I think that. You know, it's still a rare thing these days to actually see the owner behind the counter making you the coffee or selling you the ticket or making a little speech beforehand and making you feel welcome at his establishment. So I think we should raise a glass to Rodney Cook next time you have one in your hand and have a little bit of a think about what a fantastic showman he was.
Another notable cinematic passing this week, director and raconteur Michael Winner died on Monday at the age of 77. Winner was best known for the revenge thriller Death Wish and the sequels Death Wish 2 and Death Wish 3, as well as Scorpio and A Chorus of Disapproval. A notable Hellraiser in his day, Winner worked with a few others, including Oliver Reed in Hannibal Brooks.
That's a great Marlon film. That's a great film, Hannibal Brooks. It's about a British soldier in World War II who rescues some elephants from a zoo and takes them over the Alps like Hannibal did. It's really good.
That sounds like the sequel to Life of Pi. Or the prequel, maybe. He also worked with Marlon Brando in The Nightcomers, Robert Mitchum in The Big Sleep, and Charles Bronson in several films. All those Death Wishes, of course, but also The Mechanic and Shadow's Island. Chato's Land.
Western.
What?
And you can't even blame that on my typing.
No, I clearly can't see today. Speaking of young, Sundance is only 6 days old, and there's a lot of heat being generated in the chilly location of Park City, Utah. New Zealand feature Shopping got its world premiere there on Saturday. And, I'm sorry if I mispronounce this because I've met this lovely person before. Zia Mandavala's short Night Shift is also screening. Jane Campion's television miniseries Top of the Lake was screened theatrically in its entirety.
6 hours. Like it.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Way to go. A bit like An Angel at My Table all those years ago, and Taika Waititi is also around for his 7th or 8th Sundance, too busy to talk to us.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure why Taika's there. I don't know if he's got anything to sell necessarily or whether he's just he's a Sundance alumni and just goes every year now to be a part of the scene. Yes, we were trying to get hold of several New Zealanders who are at Sundance to get them on the show. Maybe next week we'll get a summing up, we'll get a rundown of what the Sundance experiences were like, but I would suggest that it's sleeping, movie watching, and partying. There's not much time for anything else at Sundance, is there?
No, I have a couple friends who are volunteering there this year as ushers, and they are definitely having one heck of a good time. So I can imagine that they don't have time to sit down and chat with us at the moment. They're a bit busy standing in lines trying to get into things. And
my favorite hard case Sundance story this year is David Anson from Newsweek, who apparently very early on in the festival slipped on the ice and broke his shoulder, and then still watched 4 films that day.
That's what you do.
Totally.
It's tough. Survival of the fittest. Big sales news coming out of Sundance and therefore coming to cinemas and festivals locally sometime soon, including The Summit, a documentary about K2, the second highest mountain in the world that's been bought by Madman, we think.
Yep.
If Madman could confirm that, that would be great. They usually do. They're pretty good. Other big acquisitions include comedy The Way, Way Back, which stars Sam Rockwell, Steve Carell, and Allison Janney. That's been bought by Fox Searchlight, looking for another Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah, and I've heard that it is absolutely it's going to be the big box office smash coming out of Sundance. May not be an award contender like Little Miss Sunshine was, but definitely one that's going to be big in the cinemas.
Don John's Addiction is the first feature by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and it received a great response and a check from Relativity Media, which is great. Austin Land has been bought by Sony. It's by Jerusha Hess, co-writer of Napoleon Dynamite, about a woman who's obsessed by Jane Austen, and it features Kiwi Brett McKenzie and is produced by Twilight's Stephanie Meyer.
Fascinating stuff. That's and that looks like it could be a pretty cool film, I must admit. And I think, I haven't actually checked this, but I'm guessing that Jerusha Hess is the sister of Jared Hess, who made Napoleon Dynamite. And they're Mormons, and I think Stephanie Meyer is also a Mormon, isn't she? That's what that whole Twilight thing sort of came out of. Correct me if I'm wrong, popular culture commentator in Canada.
I didn't know that Twilight was a big Mormon movement.
I think so. I think that's sort of where it's. I think that's sort of where it began. It was like a message film, a message book, you know, about with metaphorical undertones.
If someone could tell me where 50 Shades came from, that'd be great.
Yeah. What's that a metaphor for? All right. Time for some Quentin Tarantino.
Good cold evening, gentlemen. Amongst your inventory, I've been led to believe is a specimen I'm keen to acquire.
When I hear the trumpet sound...
What's your name?
I'm gonna rise right out of the ground.
Django. Then you're exactly the one I'm looking for.
Hey, stop talking to him.
Calm down. I'm simply a customer trying to conduct a transaction.
Last chance, fancy pants.
Oh, very well.
Okay, this is one that we'll do quickly today because I suspect we're going to want to revisit it next week when Simon's here. We saw it together at a screening just a little bit before Christmas, I think. And poor Kaylee in Canada hasn't seen Django Unchained yet.
It's been out and I just can't decide if I want to see it or not. So, Dan, I'm going to be holding on to your every word. I know I usually don't. I usually disagree with you, but I'm waiting.
It's not just you disagree with me. Usually you just sort of stare off into the distance like you're not even listening. Django Unchained is a Western. It's inspired by... and it's like Quentin Tarantino films always. Well, I mean, if you start down the list of things that it's inspired by, you might never end. But it is inspired by the great spaghetti westerns of the 60s and some of the not-so-great spaghetti westerns of the 60s. But it's also got a hip-hop soundtrack, a James Brown soundtrack. It's about slavery, I guess, and the character that Jamie Foxx plays, Django, is a slave who is purchased by the great Austrian actor from Inglourious Basterds, the guy that Tarantino made a star, Christoph Waltz, and he plays a dentist turned bounty hunter who knows that Django has information about, he can recognize some of his targets, right? So he buys Django and they go off on this quest. This is basically act one of the film. They go off on this quest to find these people so that they can be done away with and the bounty secured. And then in act two and act three, they join forces as bounty hunters in an effort to recover Django's wife, who just so happens to speak German. It's in a strange twist of plot, and she is a servant of Leonardo DiCaprio's plantation owner. And so they head to the wonderfully named Candyland to go and try and do a deal in which they will rescue her one way or another. So this is a film that has lots of Tarantino's characteristic wit, strange and bizarre casting, not least himself at one point playing an Australian. There's some fine performances, some very strange left turns that it takes, and some digressions. It's jolly long. It's actually longer than The Hobbit, although it doesn't feel that long. And there's a lot to enjoy in Django Unchained. It may actually be on a purely indulgent level Tarantino's most entertaining film in a very long time. It may be perhaps a little bit too long and a little bit too unfocused. Tarantino lost his editor, Sue Menges, who died, unfortunately, a couple of years ago. And so this would be the first film in a long time that's been made without her assistance. And I just get the impression that it doesn't quite have the same snap, crackle and pop that his more recent films have had. I was a really big fan of Inglourious Basterds. It's a film that I was watching again just this weekend. And for me, I really loved that delicate balance. Well, not so delicate, actually, when you think about it, as Tarantino. That balance that he finds between humor and horror, and human horror rather than sort of rather than supernatural horror. Inglourious Basterds was a sort of Holocaust movie. It was a wish fulfillment of Jewish revenge against the Nazis for what was being done, and this film Django Unchained it has that same kind of balance of humor and righteous anger and righteous indignation about slavery. There are lots of points during the film where you're under no uncertain terms about what an absurd and obscene thing slavery was, and this is going to be uncomfortable for a lot of people because it's done with some humor but I think that the anger and the indignation is just as genuine as it would be from any other liberal filmmaker. Do you have a question? Is there a hand raised at the back?
Well, I know this film has kicked up quite a bit of fuss from different groups, and Jamie Foxx has been called out for even starring in a film like this. And
well, Spike Lee won't see it.
Yeah,
and I can understand that. You know, he has described slavery as the black community's Holocaust, and he's absolutely perfectly within his rights to choose not to see it and to choose not to experience something where there's some humor made out of it. But I felt that humor was a vehicle for a genuine, righteous, humanitarian anger, and I think that's something we don't always appreciate in Tarantino, that he does have a point every now and then.
And also, a lot of people have noted the amount of violence in the film, and we all know that Tarantino makes rather violent films, but you know, recent situations, and you know, the groups calling out violence in the media and violence in films, and especially gun violence. How did that come across to you?
It's cartoon violence, as it so often is in Tarantino's films. There's a lot of digital blood, which I've never really believed. You know, you can always tell when basically that stuff is painted on the screen. So it was very hard to take the violence seriously in terms of a kind of visceral emotional response to it. It felt to me like it often does in Tarantino's films, that it's like Roadrunner and Coyote violence, you know, that it's not necessarily to be taken seriously. There are moments of emotional violence towards slaves from slave owners, and you're very conscious then of that there's some kind of kick to what he's doing. But the gunplay is really an opportunity for Tarantino to show off his filmmaking chops, it seems to me. I would say that this is a film that I feel like is better written than directed. There's some lovely dialogue in it. Christoph Waltz seems to have been born to play Tarantino, to have Tarantino's words on his lips. But I wonder whether the way that it's actually shot, a lot of those long static conversation scenes seem to be not as interesting to look at as they were in Inglourious Bastards, where there were some interesting choices of angles and framing and movement of camera, etc. This feels often to be a little bit more static, apart from the occasional sort of set piece. So I don't know if it's as cinematically successful, but I do think his writing is very close to the top of his game.
And my last question is, what is your two-word review, Dan?
I'll curse you. I would say that this would be Tarantino-esque. I need three words. Damn it. What can I do? Luckily, I'm in control of this, so I can cut all of this umming and ahhing out later on. I would say that it is... oh, crumbs! What do you do? What's? I want to say almost best Tarantino, but it's not. That's three words. Almost Tarantino at his best. That's even more words. I've got to do better. Okay. pathetic. I can see, like, you're shaking your head in Canada and you're going, what am I doing? What am I doing listening to this rubbish? As I'm sure you're thinking at home.
All right. So did you enjoy the film, Dan?
I did.
That's the important part.
I really, really enjoyed it. But I'm feeling a little bit the same way that I did with The Master, that it didn't quite measure up to what I wanted it to be. And it certainly, you know, the final 10-15 minutes, it seems to sort of just be all over the place, to be honest. But that doesn't mean that I didn't enjoy it. It was one of the most enjoyable 2.5 hours I've spent in a movie theater for a very long time. So, multi two-word review notwithstanding, that is our show for this week. Next week, it's the apocalyptic 31st of January. We've been warning about the 31st of January for weeks and weeks, and it's almost upon us, with almost a dozen fine Oscar-contending films opening on the same day. We're going to try and guide you through it. The Silver Linings Playbook we'll be talking about next week, Hitchcock, Zero Dark Thirty, Anna Karenina and Lincoln, they're all competing for your dollar next week, and we'll be trying to get through all of those. And of course, Kaylee, you're back.
I would say just go to all of them. Just do it.
Yeah. All right. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favorite podcasting software so the latest episode is always downloaded automatically. You've heard this over and over again. You don't need me to teach you how to use iTunes. You can feed back to us via social media. How do they do that, Kaylee?
Yes, you can contact us via Twitter with our Twitter handle at CinematicaCast, on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, and on our website at cinematica.co.nz.
This show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke. You can buy that at the iTunes store. And we're going to leave you with some more music. After giving Johnny Greenwood's score for The Master such a boost earlier on, I've decided not to play any. This is still from The Master, but it's actually Ella Fitzgerald singing Get Thee Behind Me, Satan, which was just brilliant, brilliantly used during the film, and a brilliant, brilliant song. Until next week, Simon will be back next week, but that's all from me.
And all from me, and I'll be back in the studio next week.
Can't wait.
Yay! I promise to wait, but I won't appear, and he may come here, Satan. He's at my gate, get thee behind me, stay where you are, it's too late. It's too late.